For KOSU, I'm Michael Cross, and it's time for This Week in Oklahoma Politics, along with Republican political consultant Neva Hill and ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel. Filing for the 2018 elections ended on Friday, and by the time the dust cleared at the state capitol, 794 people had signed up for public office, the most in pretty much recent history. Now, Neva, Election Board Secretary Paul Zierichs is hoping the increase in filings might also mean an increase in voter turnout. Any chance of that?
Well, I think it remains to be seen. I mean, well, yeah. Based on past history, I would question it. But hopefully there is enough interest among the voters this time that maybe they will do a better job of coming out and participating at the polls. So at least that's going to be the effort by all of these folks that are on the ballot to try to make that happen in their favor. But when we look at, the overall takeaway, about a month out, We found that there were three-fourths of the folks that potentially were running didn't have opponents, and then all of a sudden we get to the end of filing period and only 13% of those folks didn't have an opponent, so of the ones that were running. So, I mean, there was a lot of last-minute activity, which I thought particularly in the last day was unusual. There was still this scramble, and in some instances it was the result of people not running for re-election that left an open seat, mm-hmm. and everyone on both sides scrambling to try to find a qualified candidate that they could get behind and hopefully either keep the seat if it was a Republican seat or give the Democrats an opportunity to put someone in and have a competitive edge.
Now, of all the seats that have automatically won, actually Democrats are leading the way.
Yeah, that's pretty incredible in the metropolitan areas. And I think that's this process of realignment that we've seen in urban areas where Democrats are going to increasingly have an advantage in metropolitan core areas, Tulsa, Oklahoma City, Norman, and even in some suburban areas as well. So, to watch folks like Emily Virgin and Forrest Bennett walk without an opponent, what that really means is that I don't think that they're going to take the summer off with their feet kicked up. I think that they're going to be out on the campaign trail from everybody from Drew Edmondson to their colleagues in the House and in the Senate trying to build their numbers up in the legislature. So they're going to have a busy summer ahead of them, even though they didn't draw opponents.
And I think that's out of those 19 legislative seats, the 13 that that were Democrats that went unopposed. The interesting thing will be, particularly those that are in the metropolitan, the wider metropolitan areas, which is the majority, like you say, Ryan, is will that affect turnout and intensity in some of those areas? I mean, it may be kind of a backhanded problem because those are in many of those instances when you look at those seats, those are primarily Democratic areas where the Democrat has done very well, and even in instances where they've had Republican competition, I mean, it's been very difficult. Same is true in a very, very safe Republican seat where Democrats have run but been very unsuccessful in being able to break through. So will it have an impact? Will it give them an opportunity to go out on the campaign trail for a lot of these other folks? Yes, but what will it do in the metropolitan area where having them on the ballot, those folks, would it have made a difference in terms of intensity and turnout here?
Which is why you've got to go knock doors in your own district and say, hey, there's still a statewide election we've got to be going.
You have statewide elections. There are going to be some primary elections. There's going to be medical cannabis on the ballot this June. There are going to be a lot of things driving folks to the polls. You've got high-profile races both in the Democratic primary and the Republican primary for governor. Ultimately, in November, we're electing some of the highest offices in Oklahoma, everything from governor down to attorney general. And then all of these state legislative races where I think that, turnout could be increased a little bit. Again, it remains to be seen. These state legislative races can drive turnout, but it takes a really sophisticated field operation to do that. And, that's also the low-cost option. It's a lot cheaper to do that than it is to go run mail. And some of these districts, even TV, newspaper, if you can just get out and get on the doors and visit with voters, whether it's the candidate themselves or a volunteer, that is the most effective route to both winning votes and then making sure that folks show up on election day.
And interesting, when you look at the Democrat ticket at the top, I mean, not real stiff competition. I mean, with only two candidates running for governor versus 10 on the Republican side, intensity clearly will not be there as much. And then as you go on down ballot into those mm-hmm. secondary races, the same is true, whether there's no Democrat in a particular race or whether there's one that may have a real problem with funding and competition, that will affect not only the statewide picture, but it certainly, I think, will have implications at the legislative level.
We have some challenges to residency requirements against candidates, including Broken Arrow Republican Representative Kevin McDougall, who came under fire for posting about teachers' attitudes on social media. But most surprisingly, Neva, is this residency challenge against Attorney General Mike Hunter. What's going on there?
Well, I mean, it's a long amount of paperwork that they're going to
over 90
bring,
pages.
Yeah, 90 pages bring to the bring to this hearing next week. I believe it's on Monday, and it will be interesting. I mean, clearly there. I mean, it's going to be one of those real times for the state election board when they have to make a decision. And I think it's going to be almost this classic courtroom battle between the attorneys on both sides making their case. And it's going to be fascinating to watch. But at the end of it, I would still, at this point, having just looked over it, I mean, I would think there's still a very good likelihood that that Attorney General Hunter may prevail in this challenge.
And the residency issue was something that the opponents had brought up when he was being applying for the, where he was getting the job.
And that's why he asked for a legal memo at that time from counsel, I think outside counsel, giving him something to demonstrate to the governor that he felt that he met the residency requirement. Now, that's not dispositive. That doesn't seal the deal. You can't just show up in front of the election board and say, I've got this memo. That memo is not it's not some magic potion. So he's going to have to make a demonstration of evidence that he has, in fact, been a qualified elector in Oklahoma for the requisite amount of time. You know, I've been through one of these myself. I had my candidacy challenged based on residency. I had to go to the, in front of the election board. It is like a courtroom experience. You know, I sat there and gave testimony and presented evidence with counsel as to why I felt that I lived in Seminole and should be a qualified elector. Ultimately, went all the way up to the state Supreme Court, and the state Supreme Court found that I was a resident of Seminole. So I've got some Seminole bona fides there. I've got a Supreme Court decision that says that I'm from there. But, yeah, so it will be that. It's a totality of circumstances test. The election board may not be the final say here. I suspect that you have seasoned lawyers on both sides, both with the Attorney General and with Mr. Drummond. And I suspect that whoever doesn't prevail here may appeal that decision to the state Supreme Court.
I would think that's likely.
And sadly, I've never covered any of these the challenges. So people actually bring in lawyers. It's one guy against one
you
guy.
You don't have to. I mean, but typically, I mean, if you've got a credible challenge you believe and you want to take it to the full extent and have an opportunity to be successful, you do that. So
yeah, and it's very much like it's kind of like a trial. I mean, you can put on witnesses and you can take evidence. And you can submit evidence to the election board for their consideration.
Yeah. So, photographs, documentation, just like we've seen in some of these affidavits that have been presented already.
And I think 15 total. And I talked to Mike Zierix, and he said, or Paul Zierix, and he says, yeah, no matter what, it's just going to be done in one day. So that's going to be a really long day.
They move through them fairly quickly. And most of them, it's a very clear amount of information that they look at and go back and forth. But, you know, we'll have a handful of them out of that will be a little more complicated for sure.
Lawmakers in the House and Senate advance 7 bills designed to reform Oklahoma's criminal justice system. Supporters say they could reduce future bed needs needed in the state prisons by 9,000. Ryan, apparently the ACLU is not very happy with this.
Well, this is like taking a garden hose to a wildfire. And these are inadequate solutions and don't meet the urgency of the crisis facing the state of Oklahoma. I mean, any reform at this point is welcome. I think we can look at this, but really, and say, you know, any reform is welcome. But these are things that, frankly, we should have done years ago. And then to roll these out and then pretend that we've actually done something for criminal justice, because it really hasn't slowed or reduced the number of people that are going to go into prison. It's just slowed the growth. So instead of being at, you know, 30,000 in a few years will be, or 35,000 in a few years will be at, you know, close to 31,000. Mm-hmm. You know, we already have inmate to correction officer ratios of 1 to over 80. One correction officer to over 80 inmates on average right now. We've got 116% capacity. This doesn't even forestall the Department of Corrections request to build 2 new prisons in the state of Oklahoma. So these are, you know, good reforms. But we can't say that we've reformed the criminal justice system. And frankly, you know, given the overwhelming bipartisan support, both from the voters and what we see in the legislature, and, you know, the governor at her State of the State address, the one thing that got Democrats and Republicans out of their seat to clap at the same time was criminal justice reform. And this is all we have to show for it, is just a few bills that, if they had not been watered down by district attorneys behind closed doors, would have actually reduced the number of people behind bars. But after the district attorneys got a hold of it in a very smoke-filled room kind of a thing, where there's no transparency, and they reworked these deals and watered down already modest reforms, now all we're doing is slowing the rate at which the prison population will grow.
Neva.
Well, I would take a little better, different look at it. I would say that of these seven reform bills, what we have to see is that there is a very different attitude in this session than last session, when basically it hit a brick wall and everything stalled out. So there is progress. Is it as much as anyone wants, that we're, you know, forcefully involved in 780, 781, and want to see some, you know, some major seismic change in the area of criminal justice reform? No. But we have to move the needle. And right now, I think when you see comments being made by Senator Greg Treat, who will be the next Senate pro tem, saying that he wants to see reforms, he wants to see what the people spoke very strongly in wanting to take place, be able to make that happen. I mean, that sets the stage for next year. It also sets the stage for these lawmakers and others to talk about this out on the campaign trail and through this year, and continue to elevate this dialogue in the public forum. And I think that is important. So for the disappointment side, I think the long opportunity side is that we are seeing a shift, I think, in the mindset of being able to see some real reforms and some more significant reforms, hopefully in the next legislative session next year.
Well, it is modest. Do you think that maybe this is at least a stepping stone to go on to the next level?
Yeah, I think that we've seen lots of stepping stones. And, you know, right now, the prison system and our correction system and our criminal justice system are so broken. They're breaking families, they're breaking individuals, they're breaking communities, and they're breaking the state's budget. And we can't sit by and just, you know, like I said, this is a garden hose with a wildfire. And we can't expect to make a lot of progress like this. There was a brick wall this year, and this brick wall, you know, last year it was Representative Scott Biggs over in the House, and he refused to hear these bills at all, and they just came to a standstill. This year, all of the brick walls were behind closed doors and largely over in the Senate. There was a bill this year authored by a Republican state senator that would have made state question 780 retroactive. It would have saved the state around $10 million out of the Department of Corrections budget. That bill stalled. It didn't go anywhere. There were opportunities for real reform this legislative session that were supported by large majorities of Oklahomans, both at the ballot box with state question 780 and in the recent polls that have demonstrated that hundreds of thousands of Oklahomans still support more broad, aggressive criminal justice reform measures. And they didn't go anywhere. And instead, what they did is they deferred again to the district attorney's counsel and the district attorney's lobbyist at the state capitol, who have a demonstrated interest in protecting a broken status quo. If we're going to make deals, or if we're going to allow the very people that benefit from the broken status quo to rewrite these bills, we shouldn't be surprised when the only reforms that we get are ones that simply slow growth rather than take prison population away.
Well, and that could also change with the elections. You've got a lot of DAs who are being challenged.
A lot of DAs being challenged, including, you know, we talked about some last minute House members. Mm-hmm. State Representative Corey Williams decided at the last minute that he wasn't running for state representative again, now running for district attorney up in Stillwater. You've got some DAs that were appointed. Paul Smith, appointed from Seminole. That's Seminole, Pontotoc, and Hughes County. He's going to have a challenger down there. Tulsa County, one of the largest drivers of incarceration in the state of Oklahoma, by the sheer size of the county, you're going to have a spirited Republican primary there and a guaranteed general election. So some of these DAs are going to face some stiff competition, and hopefully what we'll see out of that is a change in attitude and conversation around criminal justice reform led by the voters.
And it's not just about the DAs. It's about, in the legislative process, it's less about backroom deals, in my opinion, and more about the process of elevating the focus and getting these lawmakers to make this a higher priority in terms of where they're going to spend their time and energy. And I think out on the campaign trail, just like we saw in the last election, we will see more and more discussion about this, which will help them as they come back to the Capitol or come for the first time to really be aggressive in wanting this to be part of the upfront discussion in terms of legislation passed.
An Oklahoma County District Judge rules the 17-month delay for the governor to fulfill the Tulsa World's Open Records request on the botched execution of Clayton Lockett was neither prompt nor reasonable. Ryan, while it's a ruling in favor of openness in government, is there anything to stop more delays from public officials?
Well, this is obviously a good ruling, but the governor, we're fighting a battle right now, a legal battle with the governor's office on behalf of two clients, one an advocate for nursing home residents and the other the publisher of the Oklahoma Observer, also seeking records. And their request, while you know, maybe a large part have been fulfilled at this point, took over 2 years to fulfill those requests. And what we've seen from the governor's office, we talked about it last week with the attorney general's office, is that there seems to be the default reaction to open records requests that they don't want to fulfill is to delay, get sued, and then draw the litigation out as long as they can, and then finally comply, whether that's under a court order or in the shadow of a court order. You know, if this gets ultimately this question of what's reasonable is going to land in front of the Supreme Court, the state Supreme Court. And it's hard to imagine any court, whether it's a district court or the state Supreme Court, looking at delays that take months, especially months that add up to over years, and say that that's reasonable and prompt responsiveness to an open records request. And that's what the law requires, is prompt and reasonable access to these records. And the idea that it takes over a year, especially over 2 years or close to 2 years in the Tulsa World's case here, is that any idea that that's prompt and reasonable is just absurd.
Neva?
I would agree, and I think that when it ultimately one of the things that's going to have to really be addressed by the court is talking about when you look at these reasonable procedures that do protect the integrity of the documents, the organization, they prevent excessive disruptions and help them really maintain their essential functions of the office, there has to be some way to bring that all together so there's some good resolution. And, you know, and from a time frame, Ryan's right, the mentality of just run the clock out on whose ever watch it is. It makes no sense because it flies against what is good for, not only good for government to have open government and an open process, but certainly not good for the public. So hopefully through this court process, we'll see something that will help everyone involved do a better job at not having these kind of long delays be continued.
Yeah, as Neva mentioned, this is not a partisan issue.
No, it shouldn't be.
Absolutely. I think if everyone would get on that page and admit and acknowledge and move forward from that point, we'd be a lot farther down the road.
Yeah.
Former Attorney General and now EPA head Scott Pruitt enters the news again this week. The Government Accountability Office finds the agency violated federal spending laws when it purchased a $43,000 soundproof telephone booth for Pruitt. Neva, this is a story that doesn't seem to want to go away.
It doesn't go away. And frankly, I mean, the Democratic Senator Tom Udall from New Mexico, the Democrats had asked for the GAO review. It's now come out this week. I think the review is one thing, and people want to know the facts, and it needs to move through the process in Congress, through the administration to get to the bottom line and see what needs to be done. But the thing I object to is that both sides, this constant politicizing. I mean, for Tom Udall to basically say that to take language in making his statements about this and talk about Scott Pruitt and his polluter friends and use all of this sensational language, I think really disrupts the total look at the facts. And so I would hope that as this moves through Congress and we get some resolution, that let's take the political, you know, just high-speed rhetoric on both sides and get down to some bottom line on what the real facts are on the money side.
Right.
Yeah, I think that Scott Pruitt's time in Washington should be numbered, but whether it is under Donald Trump or not, we just really don't know. Again, you know, what I've said before is that Trump operates on a ideology of convenience, political convenience, and if Trump feels at some point that the benefit that he's getting from Scott Pruitt is less convenient, is outweighed by the inconvenience of Scott Pruitt, then Scott Pruitt's going to go. Is the White House chief of staff, apparently there are reports now that he's encouraging the president to fire Pruitt. And you know, it's not just the phone booth, it's the outlandish travel that we've seen. It's the sweetheart deal that he got from renting an apartment from a lobbyist in the energy industry that's regulated by the EPA. It's these ethics waivers that we've seen for folks that have been former lobbyists for the energy industry or for industries that have been regulated by the EPA that have now gone to work for the EPA, that have received ethics waivers that allow them to continue to do both, to lobby for the industry and to continue to work for the entity that regulates that industry. It's the firing of people that have approached him and said, you've got to stop doing this, or the intimidation of those folks at the very least. It's going around even the White House and giving, you know, these huge exorbitant raises to staff members against the demands of both the law and from the White House. I mean, this is a guy who I think has just, you know, flouted the rule of law with the president and within the agency and just norms within Washington for quite a while now. And it's quite amazing that he's been there, especially given that he really hasn't done anything. I mean, I think that he's talked a big game, but the number of regulations and Obama era rules that he's actually been able to roll back, thank goodness, have been very few, if any.
And of course, former aide to Senator Jim Inhofe was nominated as the second in command. So even if Pruitt gets fired, there's someone back there to take his place.
Yeah, if Pruitt gets fired, we shouldn't expect that it's going to be a change in policy. It's not like Al Gore is going to come take over the EPA if Scott Pruitt gets fired.
You know, that is absolutely certain.
we could hope, but that's probably not going to happen.
Weird.
But it would be weird. You know, James Comey. I watched his interview over this last week, and I think he used the word weird like five or six times. I was like, yeah, this is a weird time, man. So, you know, weirder things have happened. Al Gore could be the administrator of the EPA. Probably not. But, yeah, you're right. I mean, he's got Inhofe's chief of staff that'll likely be the next administrator if Pruitt is gone. So it won't be a huge change in policy, but at least we can maybe see a restoration of norms as to way administrators should operate within the federal bureaucracy.
Very quickly, I want to get to the teacher walkout, which is over, but it didn't stop crowds of people still showing up at the state capitol as educators passed the torch to others who care about Oklahoma schools. We got out last week, and like within hours, they made the decision to cancel the walkout. So I wanted to get your thoughts, Ryan, first off, on what you thought about the canceling of the walkout itself.
You know, I think that that teachers did reach a point where there had to be some sort of resolution because the legislature wasn't going to move. It was very apparent that the legislature, both the House and the Senate leadership, were unresponsive to the demands that OEA was putting on the table. Even when OEA, you know, began to walk back some of those demands, and they were still unresponsive. So at some point, that was just where they were at. They weren't going to move this legislature, and I really felt that the attention had to be shifted to the candidate filing period, and then ultimately into the June and November election cycle.
Neither.
So I would just say that, you know, that after that happened, that whenever they did make that switch, I do think that declaring some sort of victory, you know, that did upset folks because, you know, they saw some victory before the walkout happened, and I think that was under the shadow of the walkout. But then to declare some sort of victory during the walkout without really shifting the real victory towards November, I think that was problematic for the teachers union.
Neva.
I think when it all started, the lawmakers made some decisions and did some things that, frankly, were what were being asked of them. And then that kind of got lost in the kind of heightened sensationalization of the entire walkout as it progressed and days went into more days. But I think the bottom line is it will be interesting to see in these elections, really. I mean, there was a lot of talk about all of these teachers that were going to be running, all of this activity in the upcoming elections. But it may well be like 2 years ago when we saw the same conversation going on, and yet very limited results in terms of both teachers running and teachers being elected. So I think we'll have to continue to wait for a little of this to settle out. I think the fact that they've gone back to the districts is important. They haven't left the Capitol. I mean, they're just limiting the numbers of teachers from the districts to six or whatever the number is in most mm-hmm. districts that they're coming back up there now through, I think, the remainder of the session. But so they're still engaged. But I think what we saw was it did become counterproductive because the things that were being thrown out on the table weren't going anywhere because they weren't well thought out and they were not plans that had any numbers of legislators that were going to be supportive of it. So I think they're back to the drawing board, and they'll have to look to next year to see how this continues.
Has changed the political landscape, though. Maybe not in this election cycle, although I think it will, I think that this is going to be an unavoidable topic for candidates out on the trail. But I do think that there are so many teachers and their supporters that went to the Capitol and saw how the Capitol works, or more importantly, mm-hmm. how it doesn't work. And that's going to be something that's going to inform the way that they engage with their government, both at a local level from these school boards that voted to bring people back. Those school board members, they ought to be worried about their election futures as well, because I think that everything from school board elections all the way up to governor, these educators are more informed and more powerful than ever.
Not only the educators, I was very excited to see that the parents are going out there. And so maybe we can actually have a state capitol that looks a little bit more like Congress, where you have people out there all the time really caring about what's going on in our, because I personally, all I care about is just people being involved
and
in state government.
And hopefully in that process, those people that do get engaged on whatever side of the issue, that they do it with factual information so that they can be credible and maintain credibility over the long haul with these lawmakers as they come to speak with them. And I think, you know, what any of them, if they go back and look at what transpired during the days of the walkout, they will see that the lawmakers spent hours, you know, making sure that their constituents that came to the Capitol had plenty of time to have face time with them, ask their questions, give their opinions. And that process, I think you're right. I think, Michael, it will continue to be ongoing in the future, and that will be a positive for all of us.
And ultimately get out there and vote.
That's right.
Ryan and Eva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the ACLU, KOSU, its staff, or management.